From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, a state wage board has voted to phase in an increase in the minimum wage for fast food workers to $15 an hour. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on new bribery charges for former Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos and his son Adam, and some officials worry that limits on property tax cap increases could severely restrict local services. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. A state wage board voted this week to phase in an increase in the minimum wage for fast food workers to $15 an hour, making New York the first state in the nation to increase the wage for a single segment of the workforce. We get more now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The wage board, appointed by Governor Cuomo, voted unanimously to phase in a major increase in the minimum wage for fast food workers over the next few years. Board chair and Buffalo mayor Byron Brown.
That provide for $15 an hour statewide. By 2018 in New York City.
In 2021 for the rest of the state. Board members say the long phase-in takes into account concerns expressed by the industry. The new rules will apply to fast food chains operating 30 or more establishments nationwide. Fast food workers who were part of an organizing effort by unions and progressive groups were jubilant. Rebecca Cornick, a Wendy's worker, says the extra money will make a big difference in her life.
I've been skipping much-needed doctor's visits and medicine, putting my health at risk. Not having the proper food to eat with my health conditions. Everything costs time and money. And I've had neither of those as a Wendy's employee. But all that is about to change now.
Governor Cuomo also spoke at the rally, saying the state's current minimum wage is simply unsustainable.
You cannot live and support a family on $18,000 per year in the state of New York, period. That's why we have to raise the minimum wage.
Cuomo predicts other states will follow New York's lead and also adopt $15 an hour minimum wages. Several cities have already voted to increase their minimum wage to $15. Cuomo says he hopes to extend the higher minimum wage to other industries as well. Since Republicans in the state legislature have been reluctant to approve bills, a likely vehicle will be through more wage boards appointed by the governor. The board's decision angered some restaurant owners and business leaders. The state's Restaurant Association calls it an extremist policy that singles out one sector of one industry, and they said the wage board was stacked against them. Ken Pokalski with the state's business council predicts that the new rules, which will increase pay and therefore labor costs by 70% for fast food operators, will only speed up a growing trend, the automation of many fast food services.
The store is going to kiosk-based ordering, which eliminates a position. You see using machines to fill, soda cups, which eliminates at least a partial position. It's not realistic to believe that the sector sees only one option, is they have to keep paying the same amount of people twice as much money for the same amount of profit.
He predicts there will be lawsuits. The recommendations voted on by the wage board now go to Governor Cuomo's labor commissioner, who will publicly post them for a 15-day comment period. After that, the new rules for increasing the minimum wage to $15 for fast food workers over the next few years can go into effect in 45 days. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, Alan, quite an article in the New York Times about some new charges, bribery charges, against the former leader of the New York State Senate and his son in the federal corruption case that got brought against them in May. Authorities allege at least $300,000 was illegally steered to Adam Skelos, Dean Skelos' son, at a job in which it starts with the conversation he had with a supervisor, and it says the conversation did not go well.
The conversation didn't go well. Apparently, according to the article, young Skelos threw his weight around, and there was a little bit of, well, these might not have been the exact words, you know who I am? and the father allegedly gets involved trying to smooth things over, and the company is very aware and willing to testify that if they did anything that would be adverse to the senator's pleasure, that things would not go well with future relationships and money making and all of the rest. One of the things that young Skelos was supposed to have done, as I remember the story here, is to have sold doctors policies on malpractice, and he didn't. And this was a problem. You know, to me, there's no question that the young Skelos didn't behave well. But what is more problematic is the idea that you're going to now start to prosecute legislators who use their influence in order to get something for one of their family members. Let me just suggest that there probably aren't enough jail cells in New York State if that becomes the standard, because there must be a lot of knees knocking in Albany. I did a tour years ago in Albany, and I remember some of the things that people were asked to do for family. And there is, of course, that specter hanging over everybody because it's too late. You can't stop now. If you did it before and somebody knows about it. We recently interviewed District Attorney Soares, and he made it clear that he couldn't talk about this because of pending cases and the fact that he might have to testify. He was on the Moreland Act Commission and testify about the cases that he knew about.
You had a conversation, you referenced it, to Albany County District Attorney David Soares.
I did.
Fascinating. He came in and...
He's a man of great courage, sure. By the way. He really is.
And he seemed very upset with not only the latest, how district attorneys can or can't handle shootings of unarmed civilians in their areas, but also how he's been treated by the executive.
Well, look, I don't think there's any secret that when the governor put a very prestigious David Soares onto the Moreland Act and then pulled out the rug from under the Moreland Act commissioners, that he did a great disservice to those folks. And so here's Soares, and the governor's not happy with him and took his money away, some of the money away from his office, which is interesting. You know, David Soares is supposed to be the guy who investigates corruption in Albany. But the legislature and the governor took his money away to make sure he doesn't have enough money to do it right. Disgusting.
There's also the case of a man who apparently stole a pair of sneakers, and many have made the case in his eyes, District Attorney Soares' eyes, look less than it really is. He described the crime to us and discussed this issue because he has come in under, as he said, trying to be tougher on crime.
Well, David Soares is a guy who was elected by a very progressive community. He is African-American, and yet he knows that if he doesn't enforce the law, which is the job of the district attorney, that he would be not doing his job. It's that simple. And he has. Now, nobody really knows what happens in each case. We have seen some terrible cases, not only in Albany, but in other places where police authority is excessive. On the other hand, you know, our cops have very, very difficult jobs. They got to get out there. They got to enforce the law. There are people who have criminal records. There are people who are abusive and who have had past convictions. And those are the things that we don't always understand.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York U.S. Senator Charles Schumer says he'll fight legislation that would allow longer trailer trucks on the nation's highways. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas has more.
One provision of the New York Secure Ammunition and Firearms Enforcement Act of 2013, commonly known as the SAFE Act, called for an ammunition database to be rolled out in January 2014. Cost and the difficulty of implementation became obstacles apparently too difficult to sidestep. An agreement signed late last week by Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan and top Cuomo aide Jim Mallattras says the idea to build a database is being shelved for now because the state police don't believe the technical wherewithal exists to create it. That news unleashed celebration among some Republicans and gun rights groups and concern among some Democrats and gun reform advocates. A rash of criticism led Governor Andrew Cuomo's counsel, Alfonso David, to say the suspension of the ammo registry program was a gesture meant to assure the public that it would not move forward prematurely. Gun rights advocates see the MOU as potentially leading to a full repeal of the SAFE Act. Cuomo spokesman Rich Azzapardi says nothing has changed. Plans to move forward with the database continue.
No provision of the SAFE Act, including the ban on internet ammunition sales, has been rolled back or altered due to this memorandum. This simply acknowledges what has been said previously. The ammunition sales database will not be prematurely introduced until the technology is ready, and it does not create an undue burden for business owners.
Republican Assemblyman Steve McLaughlin, a SAFE Act critic since day one, represents the 107th District.
What really bothers me here is that the thought that you can just roll out a memorandum of understanding and expect the people of New York to buy that and believe that that is now has the force of law is a pretty scary thought coming from a guy that's the governor and was the ex-attorney general and coming from the Senate. The fact that they think that this is going to hold water is galling to me. And in effect, this is actually weaker than a one-house bill. I mean, we pass one-house bills all the time. They don't go anywhere. This is weaker than that.
Some Democrats argued the MOU circumvents Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, which brings the pact's constitutionality into question. McLaughlin says those who support the Second Amendment aren't going to be too happy with Governor Cuomo if they have to go through a background check every time they buy a box of 22 shells.
So it's one of two things. He's afraid to roll it out, or let's say they can't get it built. So what they're saying is we can't get this thing built anyway. So let's pretend that we're not going to roll out the background check until some later date in the future, which is undetermined by us. I mean, it's just, it is bizarre. That's my read on it.
The Working Families Party went so far as to suggest the governor was willing to chuck the gun law to foster goodwill with Republicans. Again, Cuomo spokesman as a party.
It's no longer surprising that the same advocates who are paid to oppose the governor continue to ignore his progressive record and cherry-pick issues to get outraged about.
David released a statement bent on clarifying what he called the mischaracterization of the MOU, which reads in part, "The memorandum can in no way supersede the law as passed by the legislature, and further, there is nothing in the memorandum that is inconsistent with the letter, spirit, or intent of the law. We need an operational database, but it must also be effective and functional. It will promote public safety and save lives. Responsible government requires nothing less."
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
A vast majority of New York State Assembly members recently sent letters to General Electric and Governor Andrew Cuomo asking for more PCB removal along the Hudson River. We get more from the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard.
His EPA-approved plan to remove toxic PCB chemicals from the Hudson River wraps up this fall, but more than 140 members of the New York State Assembly are urging General Electric to dredge additional PCB hotspots throughout the river. Democratic Assemblywoman Kerry Warner's district includes Washington and Saratoga counties, where the dredging is taking place.
I think that the task of cleaning up the section of the Hudson River from the southern end of the Champlain Canal, north to Fort Edward and Hudson Falls, is not fully done. And we need to, while the facilities are still in place, We need GE to finish the job.
Assemblyman Dan Steck of Queensbury is the ranking Republican on the Assembly's Environmental Conservation Committee. He says the time to act is now as GE works to finish its final season of dredging.
Mobilization of the effort is a big part of the expense. So, you know, once the equipment is packed up and leaves, that's a big deal to ever, you know, say, hey, you know, we wish that we had done this 10 years ago. Let's try to get it back here. So, you know, the appropriate time to say, are we sure that we're satisfied? Are we sure that we're done and in a good place for the community, is to do it now.
General Electric is standing by its work plan approved by the Environmental Protection Agency. Spokesman Mark Behan.
What the assembly members are asking for is something that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has said is not necessary, and that is additional dredging in the Hudson River. When GE completes its work this year on the Hudson, the dredging project, we will have addressed 100% of the PCBs that EPA targeted.
Environmental groups want more cleanup, too. Althea Malarkey, public policy and special project analyst at Scenic Hudson, says GE is obligated to clean up more than is sought by EPA.
They know, and everyone else is very well aware, that they have liabilities and responsibilities beyond the EPA-mandated cleanup, which we've known all along is not enough. They're not getting enough out.
The letter cites work done by the federal trustees, state and federal agencies that have been working on a natural resources damages assessment to assess the company's liability to the public. It also mentions a report by the Hudson's Contamination Assessment and Reduction Project that called the PCB contamination an economic ball and chain. EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck said in May EPA acknowledged the desire by others, including the trustees, to pursue additional dredging in the New York State Canal.
If the Natural Resource Trustees reach an agreement with GE, EPA is very happy to keep that infrastructure in place. However, we need to know very soon.
GE's work on the Hudson will continue after the dredging phase is ended this fall, including habitat restoration work and PCB monitoring. Again, company spokesman Mark Behan.
EPA considered even larger dredging projects, but it ultimately selected a project that was more balanced, where there was very significant dredging in some parts of the river and less dredging in others. And the reason it chose that balanced approach was to ensure that the project delivered the environmental benefits that it should deliver with the least risk to the river and wildlife and ecology and the least disruption to communities along the river.
A call to Governor Cuomo's office for comment on the letter was not returned.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. In 2011, New York passed a law imposing a limit on increases in the property tax. The cap for 2016 will be less than 1%, and some officials worry that could severely restrict local services. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley explains.
New York's property tax cap is set at the rate of inflation or 2%, whichever is less. Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli notified local governments Monday that newly released Consumer Price Index data is down, and that means local governments must adjust their tax cap to 0.73%, which is a significant reduction over prior years. DiNapoli explained that it will affect communities with calendar-based fiscal years, including counties, town, fire districts, villages, and many cities.
In some communities, it might very well mean having to cut back on some services, perhaps not fill certain positions. put off some capital projects. What we've seen in many communities, they've been able to comply with the tax cap because they've been expending their fund balance, or they have reserves that have helped them still provide the services they would like to provide without exceeding the cap. But as time has gone on, you see in many communities that fund balance, that rainy day funds, however you want to describe it, has become smaller and smaller. So I do think you're going to see some tough choices at the local level.
The New York State Association of Counties notes that the State Department of Taxation and Finance second quarter sales tax revenue report issued last week showed dozens of counties experiencing reductions in sales taxes and reduced revenues during the first 6 months of the fiscal year. Deputy Director Mark Levine calls the lower tax cap an additional and significant limitation on localities.
It's a good thing for taxpayers, but it's going to put a squeeze on local governments and counties across the state. Before we spend any local tax revenue on local programs, we have to pay for 9 mandates that consume over $12 billion a year. So what we're going to see as a result of this limit on the property tax levy is continued erosion of reserves and cuts.
Plattsburgh Mayor James Calnon says his office was aware a lower tax cap rate was coming, but expected it to be approximately 1.25%. Calnon finds a less than 1% cap particularly difficult to deal with.
For us, the biggest issue is that it wavers all over the place. The high, which was the first year of the cap because the retirement rates were rising so high, we actually were allowed to raise our taxes 5.44% that year, and now we're down looking at 1%. How do you make long-term plans when you have no idea of what your taxing ability is going to be? And that might not be as serious an issue if all the rest of our revenue sources would also rise and fall with consumer price index, but they don't.
Calnon believes the tax cap system in New York is unfair.
The governor's talking about the fact that they've been able to keep state expenses at 2%. Well, why does he get 2%? And he's giving us a figure that's half that. We find this to be really limiting and I think not fairly applied.
Local governments can override the tax cap by passing a resolution or local law with a 60% vote of the governing board. But a recent report by the comptroller showed just 6 counties overriding the cap this year.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1530 or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.